Good morning. I am Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. We're very pleased to have Mr. Jeff Valletta back in our studio this week to talk about the very exciting and innovative things that we're doing, that they're doing at Fahrenheit 212. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
Welcome back to you.
You know, last week's interview, we were talking about your business model at the very end, and I just wanted to really stress that again, because a lot of companies don't put their money where their mouth is, and obviously yours does. Can you go into a little bit more detail about your business model?
Sure. So again, just regrouping where we finished last time, it is a business model that's very straightforward. Put two-thirds of the revenue that we expect to earn on any given job at risk. We give our clients the complete freedom to define those metrics, those milestones for success. We expect four of them. We want three of them to be achieved or not, or be able to be achieved or not within 3 years, and 3 years of the job starting. And, you know, there is an amount of money that we would expect at that, and they're allowed to allocate that across those milestones of their making and whatever ratio they decide. And we are now in a situation where we are working in an entirely transparent way. I mean, we're an outcome-obsessed business simply because we're an outcome-paid one, and the milestones that we're being paid against are very, very often the milestones that our executives that we're working with are being incented to themselves, or at least they are the ones that the company looking in on this, on this growth job, will be measuring its success or otherwise.
And share with us the case study of Samsung. I believe that they had come to Fahrenheit 212, and your company came up with a very innovative way to use their monitors.
They came to us in a way that's not untypical for companies to come to us. They had an existing asset. It was LCD screens. And they were looking for us to find large-scale new applications or new uses for that machine beyond the three verticals, mobile phones and computers and TVs and displays, in which LCDs are played out today. And there was real market reason for that. You know, the price was, the wholesale price of that was dropping at a rate that was, you know, frightening for a company that makes, you know, a lot of its profit out of this business unit. So we had to help them identify what other verticals the arrival or the advent of a piece of glass could do to create an experience that wasn't there or make better one that was. And, there were two or three ideas that came from that portfolio that they've gone on to commercialize, but one of them was in the vending space. And vending was very interesting for us because, One, it was a big enough addressable market. We were looking for large-scale applications, things at least 600,000 units or more a year, at a screen size 10 inches bigger, and I think 2% of the world vending machine industry is 600,000 units. So if we had a good enough idea, we certainly had a big enough addressable audience. And secondly, the industry that manufactures vending machines had been in decline over the previous 15 years for no good reason, more than the fact that they had no real reason to go forward. It was, the same bicycle technology that you'd found in a vending machine, ever since it had been invented, 40, 50 years before. But the other thing that was really exciting to us in our ability to create some market power and some market influence is that there were three companies in the world, Suntory out of Japan and the PepsiCo business and Coca-Cola, to whom, owned a very, very big, large share of that market. So, two or three sales calls and success out of that could, create a market quickly. So we developed a simple idea of just replacing the front of a vending machine's window with an LCD screen to enable a lot more interactivity between, the consumer and the product itself, and it allowed a Coke or a Pepsi or whatever to be able to communicate on that screen, everything that it had inside that machine, not just, a dumb static sign that sat on the outside of it. But I think the novelty, the real innovation came in an ability to think that we could in fact connect these all up, and that, you know, if Coke was to, you know, retrofit an existing established asset around the world and connect these vending machines up, then they could sit in Atlanta and use it as would be a media channel and put anything on any screen at any time anywhere in the world that it chose to, and use that as a total sort of living laboratory on testing out responses and receptivities of people. So, you know, a very, very 21st century sort of marketing activation device from a, you know, a very, very, you know, 19th century piece of technology.
That's amazing. And did they also run commercials?
They could do whatever they liked. I mean, one of the most important things, of course, is that, you know, if you take a brand like Coke, you know, one of the proudest brand marketers in the world and one of the biggest investors in brands in the world, but even Coke can only advertise its brands rather than advertise its SKUs, you know. And if you take a brand like Fanta, there are 38 different SKUs of Fanta. Even Sprite, which only comes in one flavor, has 14, 15 SKUs. Now we were giving them an incredibly cheap digital way of communicating a SKU, a flavor, as it were, right at the point where somebody could buy it, and they'd never been able to, you know, to be able to do that before.
That is phenomenal. That is just phenomenal. And the name Fahrenheit, I understand that you almost named the company Velocity Made Good.
Yeah. There's a short answer and a long answer to this. I'll try and do it in a little bit in the middle. One of the most, you know, there's been many, many things I have adored about working in this country, and I'm a person that very much lives for the day. But it has been the only thing I've ever thought in my life what would have happened to me if I'd actually come to America a lot earlier in my life. But, you know, there are a couple of things about America that are kind of dicky and annoying, and one of them is that it's an incredibly litigious country, and, you know, 8 or 9% of the world's economy and wealth and 21% of the world's lawyers. But we found ourselves in a situation where a previous encounter way back in the history of Saatchi's had led to a situation where there was a company called Velocity somewhere, I believe in Boston or somewhere, that was an ad agency that was using the name Velocity, that there'd been some ill wind between them and Saatchi's. And even though we were setting up an innovation company that had nothing to do with advertising, I was still a board director of that company, and I was setting up a business called Velocity Made Good. The lawyers didn't think we had much of a chance if they ever had a crack at us. But Velocity Made Good's a beautiful term. It's a very, very elegant new piece of language that came out of the world of match racing. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, something that's pretty dear to every New Zealander's heart. And, you know, the silly, stupid idiot that has to climb to the top of the mast that's looking at the weather ahead of the boat, you know, relays that information back to the tactician who plots what is called the velocity made good and gives that instruction to the skipper. And, of course, in yacht racing, that's not always the straight line. So it's just the smartest way to an end point, you know. And that's what we were going to call it. But anyway, lawyers said it would be a bit foolish. So Fahrenheit 212 it became in about 10 minutes. We had to come up with that. But I can't imagine it's been called anything else. Fahrenheit 212, is boiling point. And if you're a believer in fundamental sciences, that I certainly am, you know, the difference between 211 and 212 is one of the biggest changes in science. So,
How about that? Being that I come from the scientific publishing arena, I can appreciate that. And tell us about the Pringles. That was a very interesting twist that you put on Pringles.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those, again, it's one of those situations where clients come to you and, you know, in the same way Samsung said, here's my asset in the market and it's doing well, but I want to find different applications for it. This was the same, but a little bit different. They had a very, very good science application that they were just struggling to find the way to commercialize it. They had developed a very, very good rice-based technology that in many ways was better than potato, one, because of some important tax advantages that could come from it, and two, it was just healthier. And but, you know, every time they tried to package that up into a solution, Consumers were going, rice equals rice crackers equals, you know, chewing cardboard is, and what the hell's that got to do with great taste? And, you know, they couldn't run away from it fast enough. I don't think, in truth, this was an innovation job. I mean, P&G certainly thought it was when we found them the solution. I just think it was more a sophisticated positioning job. They had a very good enabling technology already, but they just didn't know how to voice it. And the reality was is that the truth is, you know, in the whole world of health and wellness, if you can't compete on taste, you've got no right to be there in the first place. And we looked at the process and the way the Pringles are made, and they're made in a very, very unusual fashion to get the uniformity of that chip, and just flipped it on its head and made you think about rice not as a rice cracker, but rice as an Asian food, and how it's such an amazing infuser, you know, an absorber of flavor. So we said, look, we've turned the chip and made it round the other way. So instead of baking, you know, cutting potatoes and frying them and sticking flavor on the top, we actually start with the flavor and build out and into a chip. So there's just less room for, you know, less room for flavor, less room for fat. That's that. So, you know, we flipped the way you think about how a chip was made. And it was all centered around, the wonderful culinary, delight of taste that we all know that comes from, from wok frying, from using woks to create base flavorings in Asian food. It was totally true. That's exactly the way Pringles were made. So we had, baked the flavor in.
Mm. Wow.
And then the health consequence was a byproduct rather than the reason to buy it, you know?
Right. Because I know I'm not allowed to touch the regular Pringles because of the number of calories. But I think if I can get my hands on some of these rice Pringles, I think my wife...
More flavor, less fat, that's that.
That's right.
There you have it.
Has there been any clients that you have turned down that you felt that it just wasn't the right fit? And if you did, what was the reasons behind that?
And it happens, and I don't mean that for any other reason than, when you're being paid to perform, you're very worried and very conscious of not what we're going to do in isolation of what they're going to do with it. Mm-hmm. We are very, as much as you would find this hard to believe, when you're dealing with big, sophisticated companies, it is not uncommon for them to know more about what they want from you and less about what they're going to do with it afterwards. And we need to obsess over that they have, the competence or the capability or the means to be able to resource, unusual and unfamiliar things, to market. And, and if we see signs that they are inexperienced, ill-equipped, or aren't in a position to be able to, guarantee appropriate funding and so on, that makes us very nervous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the management structure within Fahrenheit, is it unconventional, just as you've described it, in the sense that everyone has a 100-day plan? But who manages all that? I know you have a management team. Tell us a little bit about your structure.
Well, I go back to the fact that, transparency wins, Mm-hmm. And I've been in situations myself personally in other jobs and other careers when there's just this incredible human nature thing that when you're in a void, you just naturally, instinctively think something's wrong.
Yeah,
you just think some bad shit's happening.
Yeah.
But never give anybody a void. Never, ever. Why? You don't want them to feel negative juice about things that 99% of the time just aren't there. So the 100-day plan, such an amazing thing, because you're setting and resetting your contribution to the company transparently and openly to everybody. But as an organization, we're growing very, very quickly, and things are fluid. The great thing about too a 100-day plan is you can never be more than 100 days wrong.
But
we too have a management team that meets once a week, just to do the important housekeeping stuff around, recruiting that we're looking at, making sure that our numbers are as healthy as we want them to be, making sure that, doing nothing silly about, receivables or whatever. We're, you know, importantly going through, you know, growth expansion plans at the moment and building out new office space and so on. So there are lots of sort of week-by-week decisions that need to be made. But by the same token, we break the business into, you know, into two simple areas. You work in money or you work in magic, you know. And, you know, and you're building, you work together hand in glove all the way through an organization, putting commercial tensions in and around creativity all the time. But the money team, you know, meet every Thursday in their Thursday club to share the practices for each other of the stuff that they've learned that week, and magic do the same thing. And and then I think the, one of the grooviest things about Fahrenheit is, and this kind of happened by accident, but every Thursday lunchtime we have this thing called the Genius Club, and everybody gets rostered, you know, to bring somebody or something to the company that the company doesn't know anything about. And it happens every Thursday, and, you know, and you sit around, it's cool to sit around together, and you get to see something that is amazing, and it's become incredibly competitive. So you kind of don't want to put on a shit Genius Club lunch, because last week before we had a roboticist, and, you know, next week we're going to see, you know, and it's just, it's fantastic, yeah. So you know, the groups organize themselves into, you know, into their own ability to ensure that they're sharing, they're learning all the time. The management team just do the, you know, the important housekeeping issues week by week, but 100-day plans is king and castle, you know.
When you think about innovation for your clients, and you provide them with this new idea or a new way that they can do their business, do you find that they need to adjust their culture as well, or is that separate from the innovation ideas or suggestions that you provide them?
Well, there's no point in giving them something that there's no tolerance for. So, you know, when you're learning about a company or a space for the first time, it's really important to understand, you know, fundamental things, you know, about what their capabilities are, fundamental things about, you know, market regulatory environments that just simply have to be adhered to. And it's also important to understand tolerance, you know, just what, you know, a company's tolerance level is. I don't want to produce something that they don't want to do. You know, I want to produce something that amazes them. I certainly have to produce something for them that they can't, that they have not thought of before and that they're not doing today. But, you know, the tolerance level between a Hershey Corporation and a Coke is a different tolerance level. And, you know, and it's just ignorant of you and foolhardy of you not to appreciate and, you know, and understand that difference. But it's not about culture. I don't believe culture is a function of how they want to work with you creating those ideas, and some companies want to be richly involved with you and want knowledge transfer all the time, and others go, you go away and do it and I'll only resource it when you give me something to resource. That's more about the culture. But I think what's far more important about it when you're creating things that don't exist is that you need to be as extraordinary in your creative capability to generate something that has not been invented before as much as you need to be solid in your belief that the company can execute this and profit by it. So, you know, if you dumb that down, if I'm not as exciting to the CFO of the company as I am the CEO, it won't fly. It won't fly. So, you know, our you know, the way money and magic work in our organization is, you know, when I present a portfolio of ideas for any given growth challenge to a client, they're not concepts, they're not ideas, they're commercial propositions. And, you know, and I have got every good reason to believe that, you know, this idea is unique, this idea can be done, and this idea has money in it.
Excellent. And if for the budding entrepreneur who is just out of college or B school, what advice would you give them in regards to them wanting to start an innovation business such as yours?
So that's a good question. Go and work for a good one first, right? Pinch as much stuff as you can, and learn from it would be useful. But I think that ask yourself honestly. I mean, there's a fundamental difference in anybody. The questions that you need to be confident about yourself if you're going to be an employee versus an entrepreneur are fundamental, you know. And you can be massively successful doing either. There's not a right or wrong answer there, but they are different. And you've got to ask yourself, different questions about your risk levels and, you know, and so on and so on. But I think, you know, the most important piece of advice I could give is sit down, write down three things you think you're absolutely amazing at, and then write down the three things you think you're totally shit at, mm-hmm. and then go and find somebody who thinks that the three things you're shit at, they're amazing at, mm-hmm. and let the bill find the Ben. Mm-hmm. I think it's fundamental that everybody has a partner, and the partner's got to be what you're not. The partner's got to be your foil. My partner, Mark Payne, you know, no Fahrenheit without Mark Payne, you know. Mm-hmm. His work style is different from me. His confidence is different from me. His capabilities are different from me, you know. And you know, and we've been together now for 12 years. I can't imagine a second without him. It's not that we have to be best mates. We hardly ever socialize, you know. But he is the opposite of me, and that's just been extremely, extremely important in building out something that's better than the sum of either of us.
Wow, so he's your yin to your yang.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a totally, you know, and I tell you what, a problem shared is a problem halved, you know. If you want the courage to be an entrepreneur, one of the ways you can give yourself courage is to be honest about what you can't do and know that you have it beside you, you know.
You know, I often find that it's tough for folks to look in the mirror and be honest with themselves. That's one of the quotes that I have on my Facebook page. It's that, you know, two things a man has to do, understand his limitations and be honest with himself. Because that allows you to grow. That is such good advice. That is such good advice. And let's talk about retention. You know, there's human beings in Fahrenheit 212. Do you have any problems with retention? And how do you address that?
Well, we don't. And we don't because I think we have a structure in 100-day plans that, you know, allows people to be confident about what they're doing all the time. That it's important, it's being recognized, it's being rewarded, it's shared, it's known. You know,
wow.
But I think too, you know, it's not fair either. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, the core of Fahrenheit that, you know, came from Saatchi's is exactly the same people. We've built on it. We haven't lost anybody. But you know, we've grown, you know, dramatically in the last, you know, 15, 18 months, and, you know, and time's going to tell if I, you know, if that in fact is, you know, is successful. But, you know, you could spend a couple of hours wandering around here, and I think you'd pick up a vibe that there's not a big chance that anybody's wanting to bolt out of the door at the moment, you know.
Well, you know, after reading the article several times, you just get the vibe that it's more exciting than Google. You know, it's more exciting than Apple because you guys are really doing some dynamic things in a variety of different industries, and you're changing things for the better.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're solving big problems for big complex companies, and you know, and the variety of what you're working on is spicy and sexy and you know, I think to a person last year when we were kind of doing an autopsy on ourselves over the course of the year, there wasn't one person at Fahrenheit last year that didn't end the year better at what they did than at the beginning, and that's by their own self-admission, you know. So it gives you a great, you know, opportunity to self-grow, you know.
And what's next for Fahrenheit 212? Do you have any what they call big, hairy, audacious goals?
Of course. I mean, you meet us, you know, tell me, you know, and truthfully, you know, you meet a small company who wants to stay small, and I'm telling you, you're meeting a liar. But the, you know, I mean, well, you know, we're going through explosive growth. It's, you know, it's appropriate for a 3-4-year-old company to be doing this. I don't want to be this size. I think that we could sustain a business 4 or 5 times the size that we are. You know, I don't think we need to geographically expand to do that. We are, you know, developing further expertise and an aspect of our product that's going to have us longer involved in the commercialization journey. And we're looking at the moment at a couple of different places to play. I mean, we've engaged a very, very exciting and very fruitful relationship already with a private equity firm We're working in their portfolio companies where these companies are a lot smaller than the companies that we're used to. Mm-hmm. And we have a different financial arrangement where we are equity partners in those businesses that we're working on. These companies, you know, are different from the Citis and the Lowe's and the Best Buys and the Charles Schwab's that we work on. They don't have best practice. They're not necessarily looking for the greatest thing, the best, the most unique solution. They're looking for something in the next 18 months, 2 years, that's going to fundamentally change the valuation of their business. Mm-hmm. So there's a bigger lust to do rather than a desire for growth. It's mandated. You know, the chief exec that you're talking to is getting paid on it. And it's got a finite time frame to it. Now, we're learning there are differences too, because, you know, when you find solutions, they're very resource poor, you know. You know, unlike big companies that can, you know, put a lot of worker bees around stuff, they can't do that. But it's a very, very exciting place for us to play, and I would believe that we would, you know, have a portfolio of a lot more of those over the course of the next, you know, over the next couple of years, and that will, you know, in many ways not just grow our business, but also, you know, in the nature of the way that we're being incented on it, quite fundamentally change the valuation of our business too.
Absolutely. And has your experience been that the companies that are number one or number two are the ones who typically call on you? Have you had those companies who are like number four or five who are saying, we want to be number one, help us to become number one?
Well, you get both.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, a four or five company is usually looking with some degree of envy at the one or two. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, it's not likely in most instances to have the same level of confidence of people. So the nature of the relationship you form with a three or four is they're a lot more needy of you in many ways because they don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they haven't got, you know, not everybody's an MBA, you know, and not everybody's part of that best practice. So that they kind of require different things of you. But notwithstanding that, though, you know, the bulk of our clients are still, you know, number one, number two players in the world. They're Fortune 100 companies, and, you know, and they are, you know, not looking to get out of the top 100, you know.
Right.
But they're hard, you know, they're complicated big beasts, you know. I mean, dealing with, you know, companies that have, I think Lowe's, which is a company that we're deeply enjoying working with, it's got something like 170, 180 years of collective leadership experience doing nothing more than opening another shop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't yet done organic growth programs, and this is the first one, and it's a very exciting charge. The company's right behind it. It's an extraordinary brief we've been given, and, you know, it's all, everything that we're doing is something they've never done before, and but there's a lot of belief, you know, and a lot of good people around it. We've come up with some pretty, you know, pretty robust, pretty unusual ways of approaching it. So, you know, it's exciting. But, yeah, the three and four is, you know, often got an inferiority complex, to be honest.
Okay.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting. I'll tell you a story one day. A company I used to work for, and I went to go work for a startup that I convinced the company I left to buy the startup. But you got to have that confidence when you're taking on the giant. Well, Jeff, I tell you, where has the time gone? The time has just flown by. Is there any last words of wisdom you would like to share with our audience about leadership before we close off the program?
Oh my God! Don't give me that. I'm good at the long, not at the short. Travel for God's sake, travel. Mm-hmm. I came to this country. I could not believe when George Bush took the presidency that he'd spent 3 days outside of the country and he was running the most powerful, important country in the world. Travel gives you perspective. Perspective is so enlightening. It's where insights come from. It's where you will be a richer person. And, you know, if you're anything like me and you want to get into, you know, a meaningful commercial, creative enterprise like we are, you know, practice being great. Don't worry about being right.
Being great. Wow. We're going to close on that great thought. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here with Mr. Jeff Vuletta, the CEO of Fahrenheit 212. Jeff, thanks again for sharing with us your insights on leadership and innovation for the last 2 weeks.
A total pleasure again.
Well, this is Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. And for my friends in Rio and Amsterdam and Germany, we're streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Remember, leadership begins with you. Have a great weekend.